Who picks up the pieces when our systems fail? Sociologist Jessica Calarco joins Women Winning Divorce to reveal how women have become America's safety net and why it's time to stop carrying the burden alone.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, I sat down with sociologist and author Jessica Calarco to talk about her groundbreaking new book, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. We explored how women have become the invisible backbone of our families and our economy and the toll it takes. If you've ever felt like everything would fall apart if you stopped holding it together, this conversation is for you. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Jessica Calarco joins us. Jessica is a sociologist and a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, whose research focuses on inequality, gender, and family life. She's the author of several acclaimed books, including Negotiating Opportunities and A Field Guide to Grad School. Her latest work, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net, explores the invisible systems of care and sacrifice that keeps our families and our country running, largely on the backs of women. Today, Jessica and I will be discussing how women have become America's safety net and what that really means, the cultural and systemic pressures that push women to hold everything together, and what needs to change at home, at work, and in policy for women to truly thrive. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. I am so looking forward to our conversation today. Jessica, would you share a little bit about yourself and what inspired your research for Holding It Together?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a researcher. I do research mostly on inequalities in family life and education. My early work was mostly on inequalities in school. I spent a lot of time in classrooms observing and talking to parents and to teachers and to children. And I had my own two kids in 2014 and 2017, and I wasn't in another life place to do another kind of deep ethnographic study in schools for childcare challenges and all kinds of other family-related things. And so I was looking for a way to have a project that I had a little bit more life control over, and also one that I could get my students more involved in, too, to have them helping with data collection. And that led me to develop the book that became Holding It Together. The project started with I wanted to do a sort of longitudinal study. I was interested in how do people develop ideas about the ways they want to raise their children. And what happens when things go wrong, sort of a best laid plans of parenting kind of a study. And so I planned to follow 250 pregnant women through their first couple of years postpartum. And so we were in the field doing this data collection. We were doing surveys and in-depth interviews with these moms and their partners when the pandemic hit in 2020. And my kids were 5 and 2. They were home. It was chaotic, as lots of us experienced at the time. And so I thought about shutting down the project. But the interviews that we were doing just made so deeply, painfully clear, how much of an impact the sort of COVID upheaval was having on families with young children, and particularly on the women in those families who were not only doing the bulk of the work caring for children whose childcare centers and schools closed, but also making sure grandma got her medication, making sure that neighbors got meals when they got sick, taking over work for colleagues. And so that's part of what not only kept me going with the project, wanting to do additional data collection with these families that we've been following, but also ultimately to say yes when I had the opportunity to write this book about how we got to this place, where we rely on women as our safety net and our crisis management team instead of investing in policies that help us do that work instead.
Well, and I mean, this led you, to quite the research, right? Over 4,000 surveyed and over 400 hours of interviews, correct?
Indeed, yes. And so we added on beyond that additional 250 families that we started with. I wanted to see, how does this play out across the U.S. as a whole? And so I ended up doing some national surveys on top of the interview work that we were already doing in the field.
Well, it's fascinating to me. Now, what are some of the main ways women are absorbing the costs of systemic failure.
Yeah, I mean, so in the book, I talk about this sort of trickle-down model of care. And the idea here is that we live in a society that instead of investing in policies to help us take care of ourselves and to help take care of us when we need it, you know, policies that many of our high-income country peers have invested in, things like universal health care, universal child care, universal paid family leave, elder care programs. In the absence of those kinds of programs, we have instead used decades of propaganda to tell people you should be taking care of yourself instead. And in the context of that, though, you know, the problem is that most of us can't take care of ourselves. We have the children and the sick and the elderly who can't easily take care of their own needs. And meanwhile, to make ends meet without a strong safety net, the rest of us often have to devote so much of our time and energy to paid work that we have very little time left over to take care of ourselves, let alone anyone else. And so in that system, this is sort of where women come in the sense that most families and communities end up managing in the absence of this kind of social safety net by pushing the work of care downstream. And so usually that means men pushing the work of care onto women and their families, and women with a little bit more privilege, economic privilege, racial privilege, pushing that work onto other women in more vulnerable positions than themselves. This sort of trickle-down model is how we get to a place where women in the U.S. do almost twice as much unpaid caregiving labor as men do, you know, caring for the children and the sick and the elderly and their families and their communities. And it's also why women, and disproportionately women of color and immigrant women in the U.S., are holding the vast majority of jobs in the caregiving sector, jobs in fields like childcare, home health care, which are among the lowest paid jobs in the economy as a whole. And so as I show in the book, you know, women can easily get trapped in this system because we often leave them with, you know, nowhere to turn for support in managing the kinds of care responsibilities that are handed to them. And then once they are doing so much of that caregiving work, we give them nowhere to hide when other people see them figuring out a way to manage and then ask them to try to hold even more.
And, you know, how did this dynamic become so normalized?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a place where, you know, I talk in the book, I trace this back to the 1930s and to this notion that there were sort of big businesses and big business interests in our country that had that wanted to push us away from the kinds of New Deal policies, the kind of stronger social infrastructure that we were pursuing in the country at the time. And this led to an embrace of neoliberal rhetoric, you know, this notion that we don't really need social safety nets. We don't need to take care of people because if people can't rely on the government to take care of them, they'll take better care of themselves. And, you know, this is, you know, a deeply mythical idea. This is not actually how care works in practice. But we've spent decades pushing this through lots of different propaganda angles and kind of building this out around, I talk in the book about a series of myths that really operate to reinforce this notion that we don't need a social safety net, and also that women are the ones who are best suited to handle this work of care, to be this sort of social safety net for their families and their communities. In the book, I tell the story of this one man, this one dad who I call Dennis. You know, I use pseudonyms to protect anonymity. And he, you know, he's a fairly typical dad in the sense that, you know, he thinks of himself as a good dad, as a good partner, a good husband. Right. But at the same time, he has managed to persuade his wife that she is just happiest at home. He persuaded her. He was making about $90,000 a year working in IT, and she was making $30,000 a year as a social worker. And he persuaded her, well, you're so stressed out at work. You know, you would just be happiest if you, you know, stayed home with our kids full time. Now, granted, she was stressed out at work all the time because he wasn't doing much at home. He wasn't helping much with the housework, with the childcare. And so she was trying to manage both a full-time job and the second shift of housework and childcare. But he ultimately persuaded himself that, you know, he was being a good husband by telling her, well, if I just focus on making enough money, that you'll just be happiest in this kind of caregiving role instead. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really what played out once she did leave the workforce. You know, she was deeply stressed out as a stay-at-home mom too. But at the same time, I think it points to the ways that these kinds of myths that we tell ourselves can operate to make the people who are complicit in these kinds of systems feel justified in making these choices that end up pushing the work of care onto others in ways that allow, you know, themselves to get ahead under the kinds of pressures that we face.
And it's just so interesting, right? Because we see it playing out all the time, as your book, you know, demonstrates through all the research and conversation, but we see it. We see it every day. Now, you write that when the government and workplaces fail to support families, women step in. Can you unpack that a little bit more? Because how does that play out for all of us in everyday life?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the easiest way to unpack this is with stories. And this is part of what I try to do in the book is to really highlight the stories of real women navigating these kinds of systems. And one of the women that, that comes to mind is a woman who I'll call Tara. She grew up in a rural community in Indiana, and she, like many young women, ended up getting pregnant in high school. And at the time, her family persuaded her to have the baby, to marry her high school boyfriend instead of, you know, finishing her degree. And she and her husband initially both found jobs at a manufacturing facility, and they had a fairly, you know, stable life. They were making about $40,000 a year between the two of them, which was enough to get by in the rural community where they were living. And she planned to stay in that job. You know, she had her daughter, and then she had two more kids. She got pregnant twice more after that. And what ended up happening, though, was that when she got pregnant with her third child, she started experiencing like severe pregnancy complications, as a lot of women do with pregnancies. Her doctor basically told her, you know, you're working with heavy machinery. You're going to lose this baby. You're potentially going to put your own life at risk if you continue working for pay full time. And so she ends up, you know, having to quit her job and stay home. And she initially planned to go back to the workforce, you know, once her son was born. But at the time, she couldn't afford childcare. You know, $40,000 a year was enough to be able to make ends meet for their family, but not enough to afford, you know, infant care often costs $2,000 a month in many communities. Yes. And so she was relying heavily on her own mom, you know, to be the childcare, the sort of free childcare for her family.
Right.
But her mom had struggled with alcohol addiction and drug addiction on and off for many years. And so Tara found out while she was home on bed rest that her mom had kind of fallen back into patterns of addiction. And to the point where she had sold her mom had sold her dog for drug money. Like, I can't trust my kids with my mom anymore. Like, I can't justify going back to the workforce if my mom isn't a reliable provider of childcare. And so she ends up deciding to permanently stay home. And in the process, you know, she told me later that she was grateful that she made that decision because her son ended up being born severely prematurely with health problems that kind of pushed them. He was hospitalized with pneumonia multiple times during his first year. And then during that same period of time, she was started to get worried that her older daughter, who was about two at the time, might be autistic. She'd started to regress in terms of the developmental stages that she was reaching. And she was really worried about, you know, her daughter. She was relying on Medicaid at the time. And so there was a year-long wait list to see any providers that could get her diagnosed because she couldn't afford private testing. And so she's like, look, you know, her own dad can't even calm her down when she's having a meltdown. It's really just best if we get by, you know, on just one income and for me to stay home so that I can take care of her and manage all of this medical stuff with the kids. And I think it, you know, it points to this idea that we really, you know, even with the government programs that we do have for families, that they often don't go far enough in being able to provide the kind of support that families like Tara's need. And she talked about how, like, you know, she wished that she could get therapy for herself, but she didn't have, she's like, I'm on Medicaid, but I can't afford the copays for, and so she talked about how she has to use things like breathing exercises to calm herself down when she has panic attacks, because it's just, she doesn't have the resources, she doesn't have the time, you know, she lives in a 500 square foot mobile home, that this is what she's dealing with when it comes to, you know, trying to navigate. And so I think Tara's is sort of an extreme case, but I think it illustrates how when we don't invest in these kinds of systems, it really pushes all of this responsibility onto those who are most vulnerable. And it's almost always women who end up holding the bag.
Now, how has this intensified since the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic made clear to women kind of across the economic spectrum, you know, that there's no one coming to save us, and that so much of this is falling to us, you know, even when we're in relatively privileged positions. There's one mom in the book who I call Virginia. She's a college professor. She makes about $70,000 a year, and she's actually the primary breadwinner for her family. You know, her husband's a middle school teacher, makes about $45,000 a year. And yet, because her job offered her the flexibility to stay home, like she can kind of work from home a few days a week, or she can transition to, you know, having her meetings online, that she was still the default parent, even though she was the primary breadwinner. And she talked about there was this one chunk of time, there were 6 weeks kind of in the middle of the pandemic when she paid $2,000 to watch her own kid for 6 weeks. And she's just like, this is unsustainable. And she talked about how the sort of disillusionment she felt. I asked her, well, like, what would make this better? You know, she was dealing with kids at home and an aging mom who'd just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And she said, well, the first thing I need is I don't need another email from my employer telling me to invest in a little self-care. And she was sort of, you know, and I think that like that sentiment of like people starting to question, women starting to question, you know, do the institutions that we've relied on, do they actually have our back? Do our employers actually have our back? Do our partners actually have our back? You know, do our communities actually have our back? And really feeling that sense of being alone. And so many of the women that I talked to really described, especially in the context of the pandemic, this notion that it really is just all on us. And that I think that both that forced some hard reckoning conversations for lots of women about the kinds of jobs they were doing, the kinds of relationships they were in, the kinds of arrangements they had in their lives, and whether that was working and what it might take to have something better.
Well, which because, yeah, it was just really in everyone's face. Right. As far as especially if you had children, you know, that were school age children during that time, because you really became very apparent who is going to do what and how are we going to make this work. And, you know, I think that leads to what I'd love to talk about is, you know, from the lens of divorce, because there's the one on the one hand where, you know, the expectation to hold it all together, how does that influence a woman's decision to stay or leave a marriage?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a place where, you know, they're over. So we followed women from 2018 through 2022, the initial study that we did. And over the time period, you know, especially in the context of COVID, some of these women did end up leaving their partners or divorcing their partners. And in every case that I can think of, this unequal division of caregiving labor played a role in their decision to split up, in the sense that, you know, these were often long simmering conflicts that, you know, in the context of COVID became much more heightened. This, you know, that it was clear that things weren't working and that things weren't getting better, even when the evidence was so clear and in front of them. And so, yes, absolutely. We know that, you know, beyond if money is the biggest source of fights and discontent for couples that leads to divorce, then we know that these kinds of unequal divisions of labor, who's doing what in the household, are often a close second when it comes to you know, how couples decide whether to stay together or whether to split up. And certainly those women who were in a position to have a partner who was helping more with this, who had a husband who was stepping up to the plate and doing this kind of care work and being thoughtful about it, were grateful for that support and often much more inclined to stay. At the same time, I think it's important to acknowledge that just because women are dissatisfied with their division of labor in the household, or that they recognize that their partner isn't doing enough, that they'll necessarily be in a position to leave or to leave right away. In the book, for example, I tell the story of this one woman who I call Audrey, who I think her story is deeply tragic, but also points to the ways that being the safety net can actually put women in a more challenging position when it comes to the challenges of actually divorcing when you want to. She and her husband were trying for a second baby when the pandemic started. And then it was through a series of unfortunate events. She lost her job. They lost their childcare. He ends up taking on kind of extra paid work to try to make ends meet for their families. And they're just fighting all the time, you know, in the context of all of this upheaval, to the point where Audrey told her husband, you know, I don't want to try for a second baby. I want to put that on hold. And yet she also has health complications that mean that she can't use birth control and he refuses to use condoms. And so she told him, like, if we're going to have sex, you have to pull out every time. And he didn't. And she got pregnant and she was deeply unhappy with him and thought about leaving. And yet she was part of a very conservative, very intensely religious community. And she recognized that, like, if I leave my husband, I'm losing my whole support system too. All of these women, she kind of floated this idea, you know, in her mind, you know, she said, my husband sexually assaulted me. Like, this was not okay. He should not have done this. And she tried to kind of float this with other women around her. And they were like, oh, no, you know, this is like, this is not his fault. This is okay. This is not a problem. And so she felt like, you know, if I leave my husband, I have no job. I have no childcare. You know, I'm stuck at home. I'm now pregnant with this second child. And she felt like if I leave, I'm going to have people around me to rely on, because I can't, you know, the safety net programs that we have aren't enough to sustain the quality of life that I want for myself and my daughter, let alone my second child that's on the way. And so she ultimately decided that it made more sense to stay and that it made more sense. You know, she didn't. She said, I need health insurance. I'm dealing with all these health issues, you know, and he has good health insurance. And he, at the very least. And so ultimately, they ended up essentially living two separate lives in the same home, where, you know, they didn't talk to each other. You know, they sort of stayed together, but she was and it was the best that she could make work given the kinds of constraints that she felt economically and socially with the people around her. And so I think it speaks to the idea that, yes, we're in a moment where women are often very keenly aware of these problems, but whether they can translate that into leaving and to the freedom to leave when they want to is a question. And certainly a place where, given the lack of policy support that we provide for low-income families and for single moms in particular, that makes it a really challenging decision for a lot of women as to whether to leave or to stay.
Yes. And I think that really, that's a great example from that story about that. Now, you do also talk about the myth of personal responsibility. And I love that. What does that myth look like for women and especially mothers in our society?
I mean, we love to tell women, we love to tell moms, you know, just make good choices. That if they get the right education, if they choose the right career, if they choose the right partner, if they do all the right things in their relationships and they make all the right decisions as a mom, you know, that it's all going to be fine, that they'll be economically secure and their kids will be happy and they'll have a good relationship. But the reality is that the good choices won't necessarily save women. In the sense that I tell a series of stories in the books, you know, kind of showing how these good choices, you know, don't necessarily guarantee good outcomes, that even women who pursue the right, like get a job in a STEM field, for example, and get higher level degrees, that they can still end up becoming the default parent and you know, deeply dissatisfied with their relationships and struggling to try to manage it all at the same time. And that women who get married, because that's what we tell women to do, can often end up in relationships that don't work for them. And I think, you know, so that's a piece of it, is that these good choices, what we set up as good choices, don't necessarily save women. And also, I think what that kind of rhetoric often ignores is that, you know, the things that we hold out for women as good choices often require a great deal of privilege to make. You know, you'll often see articles, for example, with titles like The Habits of Highly Successful Women. And those habits will be things like, you know, hire a full-time housekeeper and a live-in nanny and, you know, work from home at least one day a week so that you have more schedule flexibility and, you know, spend an hour a day at the gym. And, you know, those are things that are really only accessible to a small slice of the women in our country. At the same time, they create this unrealistic set of expectations, you know, that all women could be successful if they just, you know, make these right choices, if they just follow these habits. And so many of the women that I talked to, you know, talked about the sense of guilt and the sense of kind of disappointment in themselves that they felt when they weren't able to achieve the kind of success that they were told that they were able to, that they were supposed to. I talked to one woman in a sort of like high powered career. And she described it as, you know, I feel like I'm letting everyone down all the time. She's like, I feel like I'm not, you know, I'm not being the kind of partner that I thought I would be. I'm not being the kind of mom that I thought I would be. I'm not being the kind of role model for other women at work that I thought I would be, because it just, it's all too much at the same time. And I think that that sense of blaming ourselves when we can't have it all, can't do it all, is very easy when we live in the context of this kind of messaging that, you know, you can just follow this 7-step plan to happiness and health and wealth in our society.
And that leads me to another point, because there's such a thread in your book about guilt, how women feel guilty for not doing enough, even when they're doing everything. Where does that guilt come from, and how can women start releasing it?
Yeah, I mean, this guilt comes from the myths, you know, the sense that I talk both about the sort of the myth of Mars and Venus, the idea with Dennis that we talked about before, this notion that, you know, women are just supposed to be these natural caregivers. And then there's this other myth that I talk about, the supermom myth, which is this notion. This is particularly around motherhood, but there's versions of this with other types of caregiving roles too. And it's the supermom myth in the sense that the message to women is often that, you know, your children are at risk and you are the only one who can keep them safe. And so this kind of myth, this kind of messaging gets weaponized against women. And it gets used to tell women that, oh, you need to be watching out for the vaccines. You need to be watching out for what's being taught in your kids' schools. You need to be watching out for the kinds of messaging that your kids are seeing on the internet. And it's not that those things aren't necessarily real threats, but that they're often overblown in ways that tell women that it's that they alone can keep their kids safe. And they often also work to justify underinvesting in, you know, public programs or public efforts to try to manage the kinds of risks that children are up against instead. And so this kind of guilt then, you know, this kind of internalized, you know, it's all on me, I have to do this myself kind of guilt, really puts, one woman described it as, she has kind of these news tickers kind of going in her head at all times. She's got like her work news ticker and her kid news ticker and her house news ticker. And they're all kind of running simultaneously, telling her things that she needs to be worried about and questions that she needs to be asking herself at all times. And to your question about like, how do we release this? I like to think of sociology. I'm a sociologist. The kind of work that I do is very much aimed at helping people to make sense of how social forces shape our lives. And I like to think of sociology as a force for ungaslighting, essentially helping, you know, people, and in this case, you know, women who are struggling under the weight of patriarchy, under the weight of bad policy, to kind of recognize it's not me, it's society, that there are all of these ways that policies and culture and institutions are stacked against us in ways that are designed to give us too much to carry and then to expect us to be able to carry it without any support and to blame ourselves if we start to stumble or if we start to fall. And so I think this is where, you know, seeing these stories, understanding the kinds of histories that have gone into creating the system that we find ourselves in today, and recognizing that this is systemic, that this isn't just you, that everyone is struggling under the weight of this, you know, across the economic spectrum, across the racial spectrum, not necessarily in perfectly equal ways, but in consistently patterned ways. I think that kind of understanding of these systemic forces can help us to push back against this notion that we should feel guilty about the kinds of struggles that we face.
I mean, there's just so much. And, you know, what shifts when women stop over-functioning or set firmer boundaries?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, I think it's not necessarily always that they can stop over-functioning in the moment. I find that this is most effectively done collectively, that there's risks to women when you try to do this on the individual level, especially if you're, I mean, if you're in a highly privileged position, if you have a high-paying career, if you have good support systems in place, then that's the kind of position that women can be in and start to like say, hey, I'm just not going to do X, Y, or Z. I'm going to rely on my partner to do this. I'm going to, you know, expect someone else to manage this and just step back and say no. But I do worry about, you know, telling women that like you should just stop doing things in your relationship or you should just demand that your partner, your husband do more around the house. Because for a lot of women, this notion of like tell men to do more often means tell women to nag more. And, you know, that can sometimes translate into, particularly for women that are at risk of domestic violence, you know, or are in other types of precarious positions, can lead to backlash in ways that can be threatening, especially for those who are highly economically vulnerable, who don't have that kind of personal support to fall back on. And so that's a place where, you know, I think we need systemic changes to make it more possible for women to set those boundaries without facing those kinds of risks. At the same time, I think, you know, this is a place where women can come together. There's a story that I tell at the end of the book about the Icelandic kind of women's movement that came together in the 1970s to hold a women's day off. And the idea was that women collectively across the country, they didn't call it a strike because they wanted to include women who were also stay-at-home moms or women who were, you know, full-time caregivers. But the idea was that women were not going to do anything. They were all going to take to the streets and protest that day and leave men to do everything else that women would normally do at home. And there were like news reports of men of like stores running out of sausages, the easy treats to cook for kids, and like men toting kids to work with them because they didn't know what else to do with them. And this led to massive social change. They ended up electing their first woman president. They ended up massively changing, you know, social laws, instituting things like paid family leave and universal child care in the wake of this very widespread collective public effort. And so I think that's a place where when women can stand together, can collectively say we've had enough, and can do that in a way that they're protecting the most vulnerable among them at the same time by making it a collective effort rather than just an individual stand. But that's when we can start to see the kinds of changes that can lead to a system that makes us all better protected in the end.
What can we learn from your research about advocating for fairness, both in relationships as well as in systems?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to advocating for fairness, I like to think about it as sort of a three-part system, that we need a system of care that allows all of us to live with dignity, which oftentimes means getting our basic care needs met. Things like universal health care can go a long way toward this. But it also means being able to access economic opportunities, particularly for women. One of the reasons why women are often in that position when it comes to divorce, for example, where they worry about do I leave or do I stay, is because there's a huge economic gap between their incomes and their partner's incomes. And this stems from the way that we devalue feminized labor and the way that we devalue caregiving labor in particular. So many moms that I talk to, you know, they had a master's degree and they were a teacher, but they were making $35,000 a year, where their husband has a bachelor's degree and works in, you know, like he's an accountant, or he's a, you know, he works in IT and he's making $90,000 or $80,000 a year. And that financial gap, the way that we keep those economic disparities, operates to keep women stuck in relationships, operates to keep women stuck in difficult situations, because they worry, will I be able to sustain the same level of lifestyle? Will I be able to sustain, like, provide for my kids in the same way if I don't have, you know, the same level of income that we have together in a household? And so I think this is a place where, you know, making sure that everyone has access to economic opportunities, including, you know, this is not only with, you know, supports for higher education, but also for things like thinking about how we pay public servants, you know, the kind of, you know, public care work that's often done by teachers, social workers, nurses, things along those lines that often falls to women. And then the third piece of the puzzle, I would argue, is to think about creating a system where we all are incentivized to contribute equitably and sustainably to a shared project of care. And this set of policies or programs is really about preventing paid work from taking over so much of our time and our energy that we have no incentive to contribute to that project of care. And this can look like things like 4-day work weeks or 35-hour work weeks or 30-hour work weeks, where we're kind of protecting people's time. It can look like universal paid family leave and paid sick leave and paid vacation time to make sure that people, you know, have the time to notice when their family members need additional care and to step in and to help other people in their communities and don't feel like I have to make a choice between having enough money to keep food on the table or to provide a good life for my family and being, you know, as present as I want to be in that family or in that community. And so I think this is a place where we can think about policies that not only help to sustain people economically and get them involved in paid work, but also policies that can protect us from too much paid work and make sure that we have time for the kind of unpaid care that all of us need and need to participate in as well.
Now, for women listening who are exhausted from holding it together, what's one small step they can take to start shifting that balance today?
Build a community. I know that's extra labor, but I think this is a place where mutual aid, you know, finding other women that you can be in community with, that you can share these struggles with, and that you can start to not only help support each other in the short term, that you can help to take care of each other's, you know, individual needs, but also then put each other on a stronger footing so that I think, for example, about I'm part of a number of Facebook groups for academic moms, for example. And in one of those groups, they have women that are all across the country, you know, with kids that are roughly the same ages. And in one of those groups, one of the women lost her house in a fire. And so the moms in this group kind of all came together to say, okay, we all have kids about her kid's age. How can we make sure that he gets back all of his favorite things? You know, that like, which one of us has like his favorite pair of pants? Which one of us has his favorite toys? You know, how can we work together to share with her and make sure that she's on a stable footing? And that kind of mutual aid model, I think, is really powerful, both as a way to provide that sense of solidarity and to feel like we're not in this alone, but then also to be like, okay, once we all have our needs taken care of, then we can figure out, okay, which one of us is going to run for office? Which one of us is going to, you know, how are we going to come together to go to a protest or get involved in volunteering for, you know, this organization or to support this cause that we all believe in? And so when we can help to take care of each other in the short term, that puts us in a better position to start to organize things like that women's protest in Iceland, to start to demand the kind of bigger change that we all need. So I would say the small short-term step is find solidarity with other women, with other people who are in it with you and willing to do that work alongside you to push for the kinds of bigger change that we need.
And I think that that is such great advice. And it really is so, it is accessible right now, right? Because like you were saying, you can find them online. So it may not be your neighbor, your community, your support might not be the people next door or on your street, right? That might just not work for you, or it might be too confining and you're looking for something a little bit more. And I think that's just great advice, because even if it is online, I mean, that's still a lot of support.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't. And so in part because for a lot of women, like with Audrey that I mentioned before, the physical community that you're part of might have worked for you at one point in your life, but does it work for where you are now? And is it the kind of community that will help you to best navigate the kinds of, you know, situations that you're up against? And this is a place where, you know, looking beyond those communities, I mean, ideally the communities that you're physically part of will be those communities that you can turn to, but sometimes they're not. And so it is helpful to know that there's other opportunities or other options out there for those who aren't in a position to be able to turn to the people next door.
And that leads to the next one, like, you know, for women, you know, who are struggling, how can they start asking for and expecting help without feeling the shame and guilt?
Yeah, I mean, and this is in a place where I think remembering that this is systemic, that it's the line that I said before about it, you know, it's not me, it's society. And remembering that if you are struggling, it's because we are living in a society that has been engineered to force us to DIY the kind of care and support that we need, that we have been intentionally left out to dry without the kind of support, without the kinds of policies, without the kinds of infrastructure that we need to take care of other people, let alone take care of ourselves, or take care of ourselves, let alone take care of other people. And remembering in that moment that if you are struggling with that, that it's not because you made a bad choice or did something wrong. It's that they're, you know, simply the deck is stacked against you. And that's a place where I think it can be freeing to ask for help. Once women understand that the struggles that they're facing are deeply universal, that this kind of guilt that they're experiencing, that the kind of shame that they're feeling is an engineered reality and not, it doesn't have to be this way. And that's, I think, a place where asking for help can start to feel more comfortable. Of course, it's not necessarily easy because we're also socialized, to do it ourselves, to feel like we have to take all of this on, and that we're bad mothers, we're bad women if we feel like we have to ask for help. But I think this is a place where remembering that we can be better caregivers to the extent that we have our own care needs met is another place that even if you feel like you're kind of hesitant about this notion of seeing yourself as just inherently deserving of support and care, if you remember that you can take better care of your own kids, you can take better care of your relationships, you can be better at work to the extent that you have your own care needs met, I think that's a good place to remember to ask for help too.
I think that's great. Now, Jessica, before we go, our show is called Women Winning Divorce because I do believe in, wins are wins, right? Even a small win. And that winning in life is so important. And I would love to know what winning at life means to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a great question. I think for me, winning at life means being part of an equitable and sustainable community of care, one where people see each other's needs and are able and willing to step up to take care of each other in time of need and know that other people will take care of them too. It's, a society where people are really holding it together as opposed to trying to each individually hold it together on our own. And so to me, that's what I see at Winning at Life, that it's very much when we can have those collective projects as opposed to just, and that's hard because it's not something we can individually do. But for me, that's the goal to aspire to. And sometimes that means starting very small, but I do think it's achievable in the short term on those small levels in our households, in our communities, and something we can aspire to in a bigger level as well.
I think that's great. And also just right. In some days, it's like it is today. Today, that was the little win. It might not be the same one tomorrow, but it doesn't have to be this huge all-encompassing thing all the time. But just, taking little steps towards that. Then have that support. And lastly, Jessica, where can our listeners find you for more information and resources?
Sure. So you can find my book, Holding It Together, at your favorite bookstore. You can find more about me on my website at jessicacalarco.com. And I'm on social media, Blue Sky, LinkedIn, Instagram, things along those lines, mostly at Jessica Calarco.
Wonderful. Well, we've reached the end of our show today. Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us to discuss how women have become America's safety net, the pressures that come with holding it all together, and what needs to change for women to truly thrive.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming. But it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.